I'm Matt Welch, and you are listening to The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Reason Podcast is where we talk to Reason's senior editorial brain trust, in this case, Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangu Ward, and Peter Suderman, who are all on the line via the magic of voice over various things. We are going to attempt this week to talk about all kinds of things in the news, including the special election down in Alabama, the Roy Moore, all of the Al Franken, Barenthold Franks, the Me Too sex death happening all over the world, Bitcoin going from like 8,000 to 16,000 in a second and a half, and a bunch of other stuff too. But we can't help but weigh in on the most important bit of fake news that's happened in at least 48 hours, which is that the President of the United States has decided to take to Twitter to call for the firing of someone that all of us have worked with before, Dave Weigel of the Washington Post. Weigel, Delaware Dave Weigel, had posted a tweet showing a picture of a Trump rally in Pensacola, Florida, with empty seats. Trump pointed out that the photo was not a legit photo from the rally. Weigel had apologized. Trump says it's in fact fake news and he should be fired. And all of the political Twitters have been and media Twitters have been talking about that ever since then. Since we have at least two people on this phone call who have been in the position of managing Dave Weigel in the past, I'm going to put us in the back of the line. But Peter Suderman, let's just sort of start with you. There's been a lot of people saying this is a kind of unprecedented moment and chilling on free speech when a president is asking for a reporter to be fired. Do you feel like that, or is it just too hard not to stop giggling thinking that it's about Dave Weigel?
So, you know, full disclosure, I've actually never worked with him, but I have been on vacation with Dave Weigel. I've known him for like a decade plus, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, look, Dave was wrong. He apologized. He pulled the tweet. He said it was even fair to criticize him. I think he, you know, sort of handled this pretty well. On the one hand, I think what Dave did is sort of shows kind of that in some cases, mainstream news reporters, not just pundits, can be a little bit too quick on the trigger when it comes to criticizing or sort of snark tweeting, sort of trying to take down or the president's statements on Twitter. And that is a danger both of this presidency, of how the media is handling this presidency, and of Twitter as a form. Right. This wasn't a Washington Post article and it wouldn't have gotten through the Washington Post process. On the other hand, I also think that this is really indicative of how Trump treats the press and how Trump treats the presidency. I mean, this is just a petty and pointless feud ginned up on a Saturday night because Trump or perhaps his social media team don't have anything better to do. And this guy, you know, Trump comes out of the world of tabloid gossip and reality television, and feuds are the fuel, the currency with which those run on. And so in a lot of ways, I think this is what he knows how to do. It's also where his heart is at. He loves bashing the press. He loves going after the press directly. He has gone after, you know, the Jeff Bezos Washington Post because of stuff that they have published throughout the campaign and as president. I also think this is part of what the Republican base really lives for right now. We see that in part with Roy Moore, who we're going to talk about later, who you, Matt, have described as a troll candidate. And it's a bad way, I think, to go about criticizing the press. Like I said, Dave made a mistake. And the press does make mistakes, and they in particular make a certain type of mistake when it comes with Donald Trump, when it comes to Donald Trump. But it's not a good way to think about to go about criticizing it, because what Trump wants here is not a better press. He wants no press or a subservient press. And that is the subtext of all of this. And that's what I find so disturbing.
I want to push back on that a little bit, Peter, not because you're not wrong about Donald Trump, but this isn't a story about Donald Trump. It ultimately is a story about the press. And the one thing, I love Dave to death. I'm the one who hired him originally. And I've watched with, pride is probably the wrong word, but like I followed his interest, his career with interest as it went through various ups and downs, including an earlier job at the Washington Post that he got bounced for when it came out that he was posting incredibly awful things on the old Journo list that was founded by Vox Media's Ezra Klein, which was a way in which it was a private invitation-only list of mostly liberal journalists who coordinated stories and coverage and shot the shit about politics and how they might cover stuff. And it veered into clear activism towards Barack Obama at various points. I can't do anything. None of us on this call can do anything about the president. We all know what Donald Trump is, and we all disagree with him, strongly on a lot of things. And the one thing that's different about Reason's coverage than a lot of places is that we're not pretending that he is Voldemort, pure and simple. And so that if he gives daisies to a children, it's only because he's Adolf Hitler in Triumph of the Will or something. We're trying to sketch things out. This is a press story. And the one thing that bugs me about it is that the press, which is suffering in a broad sense from Trump derangement syndrome, meaning that they will believe and kind of report on anything negative very quickly. And the lines between establishment gatekeeper institutions like the Washington Post and more, quick on the trigger blogging kind of gossip fodder has all blurred in a lot of different ways. And in many ways, the Washington Post is leading that precisely because Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon, who is also a Reason contributor to the nonprofit that publishes us, is pushing that because that's where things are going. The press needs to think about this type of stuff, and it's not simply tweeting stuff out really quickly without verifying it. It's also, there's a tweet that Dave said, he has like 365,000 or almost 400,000 Twitter followers, and he said, everything I tweet is meant kind of ironically, except for attacks on a Daily Beast reporter who all of us are friends with and somebody at Reason is actually engaged to. That's wrong. I don't know exactly what the Washington Post's policy is. And, Reason has a very loose policy in terms of where does social media follow? The reason why Dave has so many followers is because he's at the Washington Post. It does imply a certain kind of journalistic seriousness in what he's tweeting about. So when you say this was a tweet, it wasn't a story, it should be it should be held to a very different standard. It should, but I'm not sure exactly where it is. And the press is suffering rightly in many instances from a historic low rating of confidence among readers and among the American people. Trump is building. He's feeding off of that. But the fact is that the press needs to figure out how to maintain, restore, and increase credibility. And this type of stuff doesn't do that. And I think it's great that he deleted the tweet and noted the deletion of the tweet very quickly and all of that. But it's remains the larger issues raised by social media and the larger issues raised by a open animus against the president from mainstream media remains a problem.
Catherine, is my soul threatening to become as dark as Nick's when my reaction over the weekend when I was glancing at Twitter and seeing people just rally to Dave's defense was a lot of aggressive internal eye rolling? Have we become so inured to Trump's like nonstop boorish behavior that we're blaming the victim here? Or is the journalist establishment can't help but take the bait every single time.
This is, once again, the Reason Podcast's new unofficial motto, which is why not hate both? It is totally fair to say that it is completely inappropriate for the president, from his official account, to be tweeting out critiques of single tweets not tied to a formal article by random reporters
because he called for Dave to
and
be
called
fired.
For calling for a
specific
fire.
Reporter.
Totally ridiculous. The obsession with crowd size, totally ridiculous. Everything about it, totally condemnable. On the flip side, yes, that tweet was wrong. It's wrong to be wrong. Don't be wrong. I mean, I think it's not a super complicated thing, and it doesn't actually have to be despairing inducing in a broad based way. I think, to my mind, when the press gets up collectively on its collective high horses And I don't know what the horse looks like. It's like a giant centipede horse or something that we're all on. And
it's a jackalope.
It's a jackalope. And and it's because the president is calling for the firing of specific members of the press, which he does all the time. I think that's kind of fair. But, you know, I would like it, all things being equal, if we never made mistakes.
Isn't this bad media criticism? I mean, that's sort of what worries me here, is that it degrades the institution of the presidency to some extent, but it also makes for a kind of media criticism that doesn't create a better media. And so Reason have like a long history of saying, hey, the mainstream media got this one wrong, and we're going to give you better context and a better way of understanding it. And I feel like that's a common thing in ideological media, especially in conservative media.
And when this kind of stuff happens, the temptation to circle the wagons is so strong that it's like, well, you know, now we're not, you know, we should always be against everyone. But it's hard when the president is against us.
But what Trump is asking for isn't.
I've got a working theory.
Let's have it.
Here. It's a two-headed theory of media criticism, which is, on one hand, ideologically driven or partisan driven media criticism inevitably degenerates into media illiteracy. What starts off as an originally good and valid critique then becomes people saying, well, I don't know. I think they're all making it up about Roy Moore. That is not good media criticism. That's bad media criticism. Or, you know, people who have said, if Roy Moore wins, it's because of the media. No, it's because people have turned their media criticism into media illiteracy. The second half of this is that internal self-criticism on the media inevitably degenerates into circling the wagons and being very pompous about your role in the press. And there's almost no exceptions to that rule. Think about the moment that David Carr became most famous of. He was a great media critic. He was an outsider for a really long time. And he is most famous for sticking up in a documentary for his own employer against those heathens at Vice News. Not a really good, particularly great look, to be honest, although that's what people remember him for. So the partisans go eventually, they start at media literacy, they end at media illiteracy. The internal self-critics start with internal self-criticism, end up with circling the wagons. That's my theory.
I agree with that theory. I'll add also that the Washington Post had a story from their ombudsman, which ultimately is more important in the grander scheme of things, which was about the use of anonymous sources. And actually, I believe it was the New York Times, public reader or ombudsperson. Talking about it, because there's a long story which is really fascinating about Trump's media diet, which, he's looking more and more like Chauncey Gardner from Being There. He watches a lot of TV and then kind of utters, you know, instead of in that movie, Peter Sellers played a nice vapid gardener a person who ends up becoming president, and he just likes watching TV and makes gnomic, kind of statements about stuff that get taken seriously. Trump is nasty and harsh and all of that kind of stuff. But this what we're seeing now, and we're being told that it's due to, the current conditions that, again, mainstream media press, and these are the people who have a lot of anonymous sources because they can get people in positions of power to talk to them. It's a kind of justification for anonymous sources, which is not good for the press in the long run. And this is something we should be worried about. If you keep using more and more anonymous sources, and that is what's happening because, you know, people in the Trump White House, especially if they're criticizing the big guy, they don't want to be on the record, et cetera, you lose, as a reader, the ability to really kind of confirm or deny or get the smell test of whether or not, you know, first, is the anonymous source credible, because we don't know who it is. It's simply a highly placed person close to the story. And then we don't know what baggage they're bringing or what baggage the reporter is. Part of what's going on here, I think, is this radical forced transparency. And it's, you know, that it is going to affect the media in a way that we have not fully grappled with yet. And it is not going to be pretty because there's a lot of, you know, kind of journalistic privilege, both literal and figurative in a legalistic sense that we have not confronted yet. And, you know, it might mean that we end up with a shittier press or a more partisan press, but hopefully it'll be ultimately it'll be more transparent even in its biases.
Just on the anonymous sources thing, that there's been sort of a shift in how newspapers refer to their anonymous sources. They used to just say anonymous sources tell us. And then the Times switched their style to be that you have to say why the source wants to be anonymous, which is always so they don't lose their damn job. But the people kind of write around it. So there's now this wonderful convention where they say, like, sources who could not speak on the record due to the sensitive nature of their positions. And we're like, yeah, dude, we know sources. That's what we call those. But in particular, this week, we had a Politico story that we were that somebody shared in the Reason Slack, which still contained the editor's notes in the slug. And the piece referred to sources who were closely following the story. And the editor had asked the writer, could we please strengthen this to something like sources close to the story or sources who have access to information about the story.
Have knowledge of the story.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing we should remember is that, in fact, sometimes anonymous sources are just people who are also reading the news and speculating like us.
I, too, am tracking this story closely.
Yeah, and obviously using track changes and not coming out of it quickly enough. In the end, the only thing that you can rely on are, our readers to actually do media criticism and political criticism on the fly. And Matt, I agree. I think that you were right in your summation that both sides tend to circle the wagons. And I think it's, you know, just as Reason tries to get outside of the traditional political duopoly. When it comes to this, you know, this is very different. It's not partisan per se, but it's the press versus the government. We should be leading a sense of how do we do things differently that actually serves the common good. Because Peter, I think that you're retreating a little bit too much into kind of snugly of journalistic. Bromides and shibboleths that, you know, somehow this isn't something that the media can control or limit the damage of by actually doing a really fucking good job and making that clear to readers. There's always going to be readers, you know, that are not going to be interested in truthful, convincing accounts. But I think actually you can minimize that. Yeah, but it's – so what do you do? So you declare war on the president? You know, what do you do? And you know, we've had instances where, you know, people who work for Reason have tweeted various things that we're not comfortable with. Like, you know, and we haven't fully come to a clear social media policy, right? We don't insist on people having work accounts and people having non-work accounts. There's a legitimate question when it comes to something like Twitter. Everybody sees it. Retweets don't equal endorsements, which is good. But then at various points, you know, Donald Trump, whenever he retweets something stupid or from a neo-Nazi group or one of his kids does, you know, we're all over it as if some, you know, that's indicative of something that we would never allow somebody to pass judgment on us for. I mean, I don't have a horse in this fight. I like Dave, and I think he's a really good journalist, and I think his reporting has been invaluable. But I don't think he's particularly blameless here, especially on that idea that, like, don't take my Twitter feed seriously, but for God's sake, don't stop following me. I mean, if that's the implication, there's a major issue there, and it's not about him. It's a larger question of how does information flow today.
Name-checked Roy Moore a couple of times. Let's go boldly into the special election down in Alabama, which takes place tomorrow between Roy Moore. Is it tomorrow or is it next? It's tomorrow. Yeah, between Roy Moore and Doug Jones. I was looking at this for a post I wrote late last week, and it is remarkable two bits that are emphasized over and over and over in this election. One of them is the media, which we've already kind of talked about, where the Steve Bannons of the world, who is rushing to the barricades to defend Roy Moore, sees this as, hey, the dominant culture is trying to oust an implacable enemy. That's why we have to rally to his side. So let's make it all about the media. here, and Donald Trump is definitely joining in that fight. But the other one that really struck me is the extent to which abortion politics dominates this, or at least dominates the worldview of those who are thinking about voting for someone who has some questionable moral behavior in his background, which is a very polite way of talking about Roy Moore's activities. All polling that I have seen and analysis that I have seen say it's by far the number one issue for people who are going to vote for Roy Moore. It's because they've painted Doug Jones as someone who's in favor of, as Senator Ben Sass in Nebraska put it, partial birth abortion, even though partial birth abortion is illegal in this country by federal law that's been in effect since 2003. And it's just, it's amazing engaging with people on Twitter and elsewhere about that fact. They need Doug Jones to be a rip him out of the womb abortionist in order to rally to Roy Moore's defense. So, Catherine, I'll start with you on this. Is this kind of, has this been going on for the last 20 years and I haven't been paying attention of, this is kind of a logical conclusion of anti-abortion politics? Is that even though we're all essentially fighting over, you know, the 20th week or the 22nd week in terms of actual lived-in policies state by state and that the larger issue has been settled, yet those who are in a pro-life position are just saying that basically everyone on this phone call are essentially rip them out of the womb abortionists, and so therefore you're going to get to a place where it's like, as Eric Erickson said at Red State, hey, look, you know, at least he doesn't want to kill children, he just wants to molest them.
Yes, this has been going on for the last 20 years and you didn't notice. I mean, I think that's, okay, you know, the idea that that there is a huge block of voters who both feel extremely strongly about the abortion issue and don't have a grasp of the subtleties of what law is settled by whom, when, and who has control really over what our landscape of abortion law looks like. That's a big crossover. There are a lot of people in this world who kind of think that if they could just get 60 votes in the Senate, they could make abortion illegal or something. And that's true of all issues and all people. This is not something special to anti-abortion voters. Most people don't really understand how the United States government works, and most people have strong views about an issue or two, including, by the way, people on the other side of this debate who think that if they could just get 60 votes in the Senate, they could make abortion illegal for whatever category it is they want it to be legal or illegal for. I do think the temptation to always sort of point at someone and scream partial birth abortion because we discovered, you know, whatever in the early aughts that that was particularly galvanizing is dishonest. I think that's truly is a misunderstanding of our politics. But, you know, I sit next to Stephanie Slate every day and she has brought home to me in a way that my life in the blue bubble previously had not, that if you really think it's killing babies, of course it's a big deal. Of course it's a big deal. Of course it might be a bigger deal than just hitting up a couple of teenage gals for some fun times.
Hey, Nick, Pat Buchanan, your favorite columnist, had a piece last week saying, hey, look, this boils down to Roe v. Wade and getting another senator who might be able to, in this age that Donald Trump is appointing a lot of judges out there, we might be able to finally reverse this. So this vote matters. It's just from a practical and tactical point of view, are people like you and I underplaying the potential significance of having a 60th senator there
to overturn a 1973 Supreme Court decision? It's all coming together now, Matt, because you know that the Senate gets to sit. You know, there's a special secret rule where they get a mega vote to settle old, rulings that have been upheld by subsequent rulings that are based on what I think
it happens once a century, and they have to do it in a circle of candles, and it's pretty exciting. Yeah,
this is why Scalia had to die. That's the first step, right? That it was actually a witch's coven down there at that Texas dude ranch that he expired at.
Watch that movie so hard. By
I
the
believe
way.
It's been done. Look, check out The Devil's Reign with William
Sandra
Shatner,
Bullock.
Yeah,
oh,
with,
I
no,
see.
Devil's
yeah,
Reign too. With William Shatner and a young John Travolta, and you will You'll see it'll be remade shortly as this. But
does this mean that Roy Moore is Cthulhu or just his priest?
Yeah, just his priest. Yeah, just his priest. Come
on. Cthulhu.
Yeah, we don't have the CGI effects yet for Cthulhu. The Shape of Water gets us near there, but we're still, years away. We're like, relative to North Korea with a missile-bound nuke on that one, Peter. The fact of the matter is that people in Alabama who are claiming the only reason they're voting for voting for Roy Moore is against Doug Jones because of partial birth abortion. Oh, and let's call it what it is, infanticide, blah, blah, blah. That's a bunch of crap. There is no they are voting for Roy Moore because he is the Republican in a place that has not had a Republican senator in at least 25 years. It is such a reliably red state that they have now, said that they will put in a child molester, an alleged child molester because, and actually when you talk to, when you see people on the news and whatnot, they're not even saying that it's alleged. They don't care, for a wide variety of reasons, but I don't think fundamentally it is about the woman's, right to choose. It is a much larger cultural tribal kind of thing. And that's not to say that abortion isn't important to people on both sides, but out of all voters and surveys of voters routinely show this, only about 11%, whether they're pro, and it's about split equally between pro and anti, only 11% of people, voters nationwide, say that they will vote only for people who agree with them on the abortion issue. So I think this is, something that's useful for people like Steve Bannon. It's been useful for the Republican Party and for the Democratic Party, where I've heard tons of people with somebody like Mitt Romney, back when he was running for president, people would say, I kind of like him, but the abortion is a no-go thing. To the extent that that's being honest, it's an incredibly rare position.
Also, it's no longer enough to just say, okay, they're Republican and that stands for enough of what I agree with. There was actually just a Gallup poll out today that shows that Republican Party identification has dropped 5 points in the last year and Democratic Party identification has stayed flat, right? So I think one reason we're seeing some abortion talk here, maybe a little more prominently than in other elections, is because it's not enough to just say he's got on a red hat. He's got on a red tie, I guess.
And it's always worth rehearsing the early aftermath of Roe v. Wade, where there were liberal Republicans who were in favor of it. Senator Bob Packwood of Oregon, probably the most well-known pro-life Republican. But it was not exactly or immediately clear what the politics of Roe v. Wade were after it happened, including the religious politics. And Politico ran a great story that people can look up about how major Christian denominations, particularly evangelical Christian denominations, took years to kind of come to a position, partly because being anti-abortion had been so closely identified with the Catholic Church for so long that evangelicals at first, or many Protestant groups and mainline Protestant groups, were slow to adopt an anti-abortion, like a very strong anti-abortion position, because it meant siding with Catholics at a time when the fundamental religious split in America was not between secular people and religious people, but were between Catholics, the Roman Catholic Church, and all Protestants.
My longstanding theory, which I probably bored you all with already, is that once you lose an issue on a national level, then that issue becomes especially important to you in a kind of a hopeless crusade, shoulder against the wheel, the fill in the blank, the metaphor kind of way. So on the right, it's abortion policy, which is largely settled, and on the left, it's guns, which has largely been decided at the Supreme Court level. And in both cases, there's a lot of local variations that are very important, and that's where the actual fights are happening, and yet people concentrate their focus on kind of a national level. Peter, in 2006, Democrats took back Congress for the first time since 1994, in part by saying, hey, look, we need to broaden the tent, including having some pro-life voices out there. We're not going to be as rigid on this issue. That seems like now kind of an artifact of a bygone era where we're having this big sort. What are other issues in which people, right or left, that people are going to essentially flirt with supporting you know, sexual molesters because at least they're good on issue X?
Well, I mean, at least they're good on. So I mean, one sort of interesting partisan dividing line, it's not exactly what you're talking about, just in Alabama, is the issue of whether Roy Moore's, the accusations against Roy Moore are in any way credible. And we've seen, you know, multiple allegations, even some, yearbook handwriting.
Which has been at least partly discredited, by the way.
Some of the marks were made by the person who owns the yearbook, not by Roy Moore, but according to her, not the essential marks. But in any case, 71% of Republicans in Alabama do not believe the allegations against Roy Moore, and that is itself a kind of tribal anti big media, anti Democrat, anti coastal elite response.
And I think also, by the way, 71% of the people in my Twitter feed after I went on Laura Ingraham's show shortly after the yearbook emerged agree with the people of Alabama. I mean, it's okay. He's going to vote right. That's what really matters. It was these charges aren't true.
But then we also see the reactions from the Insta reactions that came from Alabama Republicans were basically boiled down to, well, they're not true, but even if they were, and actually they might be totally true, and maybe they're probably totally true, even if they were, I wouldn't want to vote for Doug. And that was like, there was actually a senior state or party official whose entire response was, well, this might well be true, but I wouldn't want to vote for Doug Jones. And, you know, I think it's sort of important to just sort of point out how blindly and stupidly partisan the reactions are here, and how it is totally avoidable because Richard Shelby, Republican senator from Alabama, has just showed us that it is possible to avoid this by saying, you know what, I'm voting for a Republican, just not Roy Moore. It's that easy to break this stupid partisan binary, and it like occurs to no one.
This is the question, Matt, that I, you know, and I think it's a good one to raise. And there's two answers to it, one about Republicans, one about Democrats. And, you know, ask Mitch McConnell, because Mitch McConnell said he believed the women, and then him and the Republican Party have officially endorsed Roy Moore. They want Roy Moore to win. So there you see at the highest level of power in the Senate, you have somebody who is willing to vote for somebody he believes is a child molester in order to keep his slim majority. And that is pretty, pretty scary, to be honest. And that's not about Donald Trump, and it's not about the media or anything. That's Mitch McConnell. And, so whatever his agenda is, that's what he's willing to pay that price on. The flip side of that is for Democrats, and I think it's bigger than Alabama. And this is actually, I think, very closely tied to Hillary Clinton's loss. She did not motivate African Americans, Doug Jones, to come out in anything like the numbers that came out for Barack Obama. And, you know, part of that, people will say, and particularly conservative critics will say, oh, that's just, you know, because he was black and it was identity politics and they wanted one of their own. Black voters have consistently talked about things like criminal justice reform and drug policy change and school choice as meaningful and important issues for them. The Democratic Party, up until very, very recently, has not been willing to actually engage that topic at all seriously at the federal level. And almost all of the push on that kind of stuff was mostly coming from libertarian-leaning Republicans like Rand Paul. And in Alabama, there are reports coming out that, you know, African-Americans voters who are overwhelmingly Democrat, you know, in the high 90% in terms of registration are like, you know what, Doug Jones hasn't really done anything for us. Like he goes back to the early 2000s. He talks a lot about getting a conviction against some old KKK members, which, you know, is obviously a good thing and everybody grants him that. But other than that, he's not speaking to any of their issues. And I think that that's true of the larger Democratic Party. And of course, we've talked a lot about this in the pages at every platform that Reason has about how Hillary Clinton was a lock 'em up Democrat in the 90s when she was first lady. She was a lock 'em up Democrat when she was a senator. And she was not particularly good on criminal justice reform in any of the presidential campaigns she ran. And I think that that's something, you know, to kind of invert your question, that's something that the Democrats really need to think about. They have taken the African-American vote for granted in many ways. And on this, I think Donald Trump was substantially right, that they're able to, you know, the Democratic Party establishment has been more inclusive and is not overtly or covertly racist or kind of uncomfortable around blacks, but they haven't done a lot for them. And I think that dam over the past couple of years, starting with Ferguson, which unleashed a lot of stuff, is really going to shake up both local politics, but especially national party politics.
Catherine, Mitch McConnell, as Nick pointed out, wavered and has now gone back out of political expediency, his approach to Roy Moore. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, Democratic senators were slow to the punch, but eventually said, hey, Al Franken, take a walk. On the House side, they did something similar with John Conyers. Is there now daylight in between those two parties and or what do you think about the Kathy Young theory? As expressed in the pages of the New York Daily News, that Franken kind of got a raw deal here.
I think that the sample size is too small yet to tell if there is systematic partisan response to how this goes. I think Al Franken's resignation, quasi-resignation speech was one of the least graceful departure speeches I have ever heard in my life. And I get that he's grumpy, but he is also not innocent. And the idea that he should be sort of saying, like, I mean, you know, I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old. They say this all the time. The other kids started it. The other kids were worse than me. I was just, and it sucks. It's garbage. That is not an appropriate morality. It is not how we do moral decision making. So, my Franken outrage has increased over time. I initially was a bit more forgiving, but his bad attitude has lost my admittedly extremely limited support. We got to wait and see. I don't know yet whether the two parties are responding differently because they're coming from different places. Republicans want to throw these guys out because family values matter. Democrats want to throw these guys out because feminism matters. And that's going to dictate different behavior in the next cycle. But I don't think we can tell yet.
You know, the one case, though, that kind of slipped through the cracks on all of this is Nancy Pelosi immediately asked I can't remember now if he was a California congressman or not, a Democrat whose name is Kuen, or I literally don't know how to pronounce his name. It's K-I-H-U-E-N, where sexual harassment allegations came out, and she immediately demanded his resignation, even as she was still defending John Conyers. So that adds to the sample size. And it points to perhaps, something more than simply a political exigency in the Democratic reaction.
I want to note real quick that I went looking for this Mitch McConnell quote. I wanted to sort of see what he had said just real quick on Google. And when I type his name, the autocomplete is the greatest joy of my life. So I want to share it with our listeners. It autocompletes Mitch McConnell turtle, Mitch McConnell Twitter, Mitch McConnell wife, Mitch McConnell net worth. So there you go.
Those are all the things that you would want to know about him. And in particular, how much does Mitch McConnell look like a turtle? So, so much. If you have never spent time looking at Mitch McConnell turtle images
and
on
I
Google
hope that
images,
you haven't. Please, God, tell us you haven't.
You should spend 10 minutes doing it.
Carry on with the serious Peter. Discussion.
Come on, Peter. It's Monday morning. We got a lot of work to do.
Peter, this morning there is a press conference somewhere, I think maybe in New York. The Brave New Films, which does lefty agitprop documentaries that are really terrible, actually, if you've watched any of them. They're organizing a press conference with three of the women who have previously accused Donald Trump, and they're very self-consciously jumping on the kind of Me Too bandwagon's probably the wrong word, but using that as an opportunity to highlight this. To the extent that Democrats are saying, okay, look, we get our pervs to resign. Al Franken resigned, so therefore Trump needs to resign. Is that a good bit of strategery?
Well, it's sort of blunt and obvious, and I think that's part of that explains part, though not all, of Al Franken's bad attitude, is that he clearly, from his resignation speech, believes that he is just being sacrificed like a pawn so that Democrats can go after Trump. And in some sense, he is. In some sense, that's right. I think there's more than that. It's not just political strategery. But in some sense, they wanted a clean house in part so that they could make these cases against Trump more cleanly and without the kind of associated hypocrisy. And I also think in some sense, there's not that much that's wrong with that. I mean, it's good that Democrats are cleaning house and wanting to go after bad actors in their own party. And we also see Republicans going after folks like Representative Trent Franks, who apparently asked two of his staffers to serve as surrogates to have his babies, and possibly not just in the, like, the medical surrogacy way, but in the, like, perhaps we need to do this the old-fashioned way.
Abrahamic Old Testament way.
Right. And so it's not that Republicans are doing absolutely nothing about anyone, but Democrats are trying to set themselves up and are setting themselves up as having the moral high ground. And so it can be both a kind of a strategic political move and an actual effort to take the moral high ground. I think that's what's going on here. And so Democrats are going to make this case against Trump. They've been making this case against Trump, though, if you recall, since before he was elected. I mean, you go back to October of 2016 before the election, and there were something like 19 women who have accused Trump of some sort of sexual misconduct. And that just kind of got, I mean, you know, there was the Access Hollywood tape that, of course, made a huge wave. And we saw, you know, the report that Pence actually volunteered to step in and become, you know, take the top of the ticket, and that people were trying to put together $800 million to pay off Trump to drop out at that time. But there were a bunch of other charges at that point, too. And so we're going to see this fight go on. Democrats are basically are arming themselves politically here. And at the same time, trying to do the right thing, cleaning house.
Nick, is this all this kind of Roy Moore support, the more bright line drawing than we've seen before on the Democratic side, which isn't that bright, but at least, you know, there's a couple of examples here. Is this going to contribute to a scenario where there's nobody who is currently under the age of 35 who will ever vote for a Republican under any circumstances for their entire life?
You know, they were already, the GOP was already well on the way to that outcome for a while, you know, at least in, you know, with the Bush presidency, particularly starting in 2004 in his reelection campaign. And it is fascinating, by the way, to go back to like 2000 and to look at the exit polling there where younger voters, you know, skewed Democratic, but it didn't, you know, it wasn't anything like it is now where, you know, Republicans are struggling, you know, to get into the, you know, decent double digits with young voters for president. And actually, Mitt Romney carried a couple of early, I think it was like 18, 19, and 20-year-olds in among millennials. He had a slight advantage over Barack Obama. So there's, you know, you can get back there. The Republican Party basically had a split agenda. You know, they split gender with Al Gore. So, you know, these things can change rapidly. And Matt, as we talked about in the Declaration of Independence, one of the things that is amazing and depressing is that whatever happened in the last election or the most immediate memory is seen as having been that way forever. You know, and so Democrats are seen as, you know, the party against free trade or against, you know, being doves in Vietnam when, you know, in fact, it's much, much more complicated than that. And Republicans are this or that. These things change all the time and they flip all the time. With Trump, I think it makes perfect sense, not simply from a political strategy, but we're going through something in terms of sexual harassment and the mores of the workplace that is much, much bigger than politics. And politics, in a way, is a lagging indicator of what happened already with, you know, all of the stuff coming out of the entertainment world in particular, and a lot of stuff that came out of the corporate world earlier in the wake of, you know, the 90s, and, you know, which began with the Clarence Thomas hearings. And I think what we're seeing here is not something exactly new, but it's the final act of a long, slow-moving transformation of gender equality kind of in the workplace and in the public sphere more generally, because as women, you know, who only entered the workforce in growing numbers after a post-war lull in the 50s and 60s are now in essentially equal or superior positions. They're as likely to be in management roles, you know, or more likely to be ever before. This is the final transformation. And this story is not going to go away until every congressman, and I suspect that it will be only men, who paid out money for a sexual harassment charge, they're going to get kicked out of office. That information is, you know, from the secret slush fund is going to come out, and it's going to have real, you know, it is going to have real ramifications, going forward. And I don't think that that's a wrong thing. And I don't think it's simply a political thing, because when you look at, you know, a lot of the people who have been bounced from media, they, you know, there's the Steven Seagal types who have been wrapped up in this, but people like Harvey Weinstein and Louis C.K. are reliable kind of liberal, public liberals, and they, you know, they've been shown the door as well.
And yet, here's your headline, right? Today on NBC, we've got a headline in their sort of think piece section. The piece is actually categorized as a hot take, which God help us all. And the headline is, Roy Moore's white female voters are part of a long history of internalized misogyny. Subhead, this acute cognitive dissonance has deep historical roots. And you're like, oh, Jesus Christ, NBC, this is why Trump won. But then you look and you're like, well, okay, you know, Roy Moore has a 35-point lead among white women without a college degree. So, you know, let's not be too hasty to map the rise of different attitudes about how we expect our legislators to treat women and women's willingness to vote for those same dirty characters.
The one thing to add on to this, by the way, which is also kind of interesting, there's the congressman Joe Barton, who people may, this was like a 1 or 2 day story, but where he was separated from his wife, and it was like a second or third wife. He had good family values ratings, but he didn't actually talk a lot about cultural issues. But he was separated from his wife. He engaged in a bunch of consensual relationships, and then essentially a bunch of explicit images of him that he had sexted with a woman came public. And I think it's good. Like, that story didn't gain traction because I think people immediately kind of recognize that, okay, this is of a different order, that, you know, the idea that all sorts of, you know, that this is a super thoroughgoing witch hunt, which, you know, we see a lot of on college campuses where what gets portrayed as sexual harassment or sexual issues that are so bad that somebody has to be bounced from a school. In a way, you know, in politics so far, I think, you know, the discussion has been much more kind of nuanced and sophisticated and discriminating. And so Joe Barton suffered the indignity of those images, but it doesn't seem like it's affected his career. And I think that's a good sign.
He actually did announce that he's not running again.
Okay,
he said,
well,
it's time to step aside.
He's also very old.
About 2 weeks.
Right?
Yeah, so it's not 100% clear that that was the sole cause. It seems like it was
contributing. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
I mean, as soon as I the internet is filled with pictures of my penis, I'm going to resign from life. But I think that
is that a promise, Matt? Because I have an itchy trigger finger here.
I know a good PI who can help you out with some access.
Don't put penis and itchy so close together there ever again.
Speaking of itchy penises, I wanted to thank all the listeners
out
there.
Best transition ever.
It's probably the best one. We rattled the tin cup for Reasons Webathon, which concluded last week on a couple of occasions on this podcast. And not only was it by far crazy, the most successful Webathon we ever had, we raised $370 $5,000, twice as much as the previous year. But a lot of the people who commented made comments about this podcast itself, including some very choice insults of Nick Gillespie. So I really appreciate all of those. I'm glad I didn't have to coach that too much. But as part of that, we got this amazing Catherine wrote a post early on in the webathon saying, hey, Bitcoin's going to cross 10,000 here any second now, so you should, reminder that you can donate in Bitcoin. Well, we got a $75,000 worth of a single individual Bitcoin donation, and by the time that came in, it was worth $11,000. And as I look at CoinDesk right now, Bitcoin trading at $16,387. People are absolutely losing their minds with how fast this thing is appreciating. This talk of a bubble. They are trading in futures. Trading is being launched this week. John McAfee, speaking of itchy penises, my God, has been talking about how Bitcoin's going to. If I can trigger disgust from Nick Gillespie, I'm doing something good.
I thought you were going to make an antivirus joke as well. McAfee antivirus.
Missed
right?
opportunity. True.
That's what the disgust was from, Matt.
From the lack of opportunity. Suderman, I know that, we had a great post from Jim Epstein last week. Alan Greenspan just absolutely befuddled how currency can work without being centrally managed, which is just hilarious on a thousand different levels. But Suderman, I know that you were panicking about having to maybe write a post about Bitcoin last week. So I want to first tap into your knowledge. First, do you own any Bitcoin? Second, why not? And then third, bubble, or how much fun are you having watching CoinDesk and refreshing constantly?
It wasn't panic, Matt. I was thrilled about the opportunity to write about Bitcoin. I have been kind of following Bitcoin from the sidelines for quite a few years. A bunch of my college friends got into it real early, and a bunch of them had like half a dozen computers set up in their basements running, mining Bitcoin for a year or two, and kept telling me how easy it was to spend like $250 on a machine that runs an operating system that even you could figure out, Matt.
Fact check.
Yeah. But like, you just like, it's, and they all did this and spent like $2,000 setting up their machines and then sold their Bitcoins for like $1,200 early on. But if I had done it, no, I would have been the smart. No, it's one answer is no, I don't own any Bitcoin. I think the great thing about what we're seeing happening with Bitcoin right now is not that it proves anyone right, but that it proves so many people wrong. Because what we don't – the thing about Bitcoin is we still don't know what it's going to end up being, and we still don't really understand how it is going to end up being used, whether it's going to be actually a kind of a useful currency in the way that dollars are, in the way that your credit card is, or whether it's going to be something a little bit more removed from currency, a little bit more like gold, like an investment, or somewhere in between. And it is, sort of one of the most interesting ways I've heard Bitcoin described over the years is that you have to stop thinking about it just as like, well, it's just digital money. It is. People are using it that way. In fact, it is a new technology, a new way to think about organizing mass systems of information, which is what money is to begin with. It is a way of it is a distributed. Yes, there's a central bank and all that, but it is a money allows us to have a kind of a distributed price system. And Bitcoin takes the centralization part out of that completely. And so that is what fascinates me about all of this. And what thrills me every time I see Bitcoin jump in value and Alan Greenspan or some other kind of conventional econ wonk just be utterly befuddled by how all of this is working and how all of it happens. And I don't know that Bitcoin will end up being, sort of a revolution in money, but I think it is going to be some kind of a revolution in technology. And I bet that the actual best use for it will be one that we have not seen yet.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say that, if Bitcoin follows its original premise, which, of course, it won't, as good libertarians, when it was created, it was essentially explicitly done as a kind of test of Milton Friedman's theory of money and of stopping inflation while also creating a kind of masterless money supply. But it will not – I mean, right now, Bitcoin is speculation. If it is going to become what it was kind of intended as, which is a medium of exchange that is that can't be inflated or deflated by a central government pursuing, you know, kind of national economic policy, that's – you know, that remains to be seen. And when somebody help me out, when is the last Bitcoin supposed to be mined finally or put into circulation? We're still years away from that, right?
It depends is the answer with literally everything about Bitcoin, but kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I mean, it's not a good money supply. I mean, this is it's like, you know, using German currents, German marks in the 1920s or something like that. It's good as speculation. I agree with Peter that it's kind of interesting to see somebody like Alan Greenspan, who was not only the head of the Federal Reserve, you know, who helped lead us into all sorts of various bubbles, but also before that was an Ayn Rand gold bug. Of course, he's. And he's also like 800 years old and probably has trouble calling you on your jitterbug phone, Matt, because there's too many buttons to push. It is, you know, that, you know, if people can't get behind the idea that there can be media of exchange that are beyond government control, they are, you know, they're not long for this world. But the other thing is the underlying blockchain technology, which allows for kind of almost virtually immediate transparent settlement of accounts that's already being put into place in a variety of financial markets in different ways. And that underlying technology is going to change things. Exactly what it means, that remains to be seen. But that kind of you know, universal immediate settlement that's transparent to everybody involved in a particular exchange of information or of goods of goods and services, et cetera, that you know, that's going to really, really have a profound influence on how people do business and interact.
Catherine, the most hilarious anti-Bitcoin take I think that we've seen in a while was, I believe, in the New Republic last week, making the case that Bitcoin is going to single-handedly accelerate global warming past the crisis point and make it all kind of blow up. You, I'm sure, have beers with Jim Harper every 3 months. What are you worried about in terms of what the government can do badly to Bitcoin, or has the horse already left the barn?
I think there is actually a world in which the government could easily destroy Bitcoin forever. Like, this is the kind of thing that flourishes just below the radar. Right now, there's an obsession on the Hill with a sort of subset of this question, which is other kinds of altcoins being used as a way of essentially as fundraising in a way that sort of eludes all of the definitions of all of the different kinds of money that currently exist on Capitol Hill. Bitcoin got this far because it stayed below the radar. It is now on the radar. I am incredibly nervous. It will be hard to kill. It is designed to be incredibly hard to kill. But other experiments in quasi-anonymous non-governmental money were also designed that way and were also murdered in their cribs. I'm thinking here of the PayPal experiment most prominently. Again, Bitcoin will be much harder to kill, but far from impossible. It is connected into our money supply in all kinds of ways. And I never underestimate the power of the state to fuck up something good and interesting.
The government can definitely make it a lot less useful.
Right. I mean, if in the end you can never use it as money, as Peter says, it doesn't mean the sort of fundamental innovation of the blockchain, the idea of making more literal and more real that prices are information and vice versa. Like, all of that still has tons of potential, but if the government decides it doesn't want us to buy things with Bitcoin, it can basically stop us, and that would be unfortunate.
All right, lightning round here before we peace out. Looking for any stories that you guys are following that we haven't talked or that are otherwise under the radar. Suderman, you go first.
It's not under the radar. In my heart, there's a new Star Wars coming out on Friday, and I'm so excited. That's all.
But it's going to be totally like PC, man. It's going to be, you know, social justice warrior Star Wars, isn't it?
I haven't heard anything like that or about it. I just know that Rian Johnson, I'm not quite sure how you pronounce the director's name, is directing this one, and I really like him much better than I like J.J. Abrams, who directed the last one. It's got porgs in it, and they look really cute, and I'm very much looking forward to buying the plushie.
I'm sorry, what
Peter,
is that?
Peter, Peter.
What is that thing that you just
porgs.
Said? What's a porg?
Google Star Wars porg, and it will show you a cute little, like, gerbil alien creature face.
God, it's a 21st century like, Ewok. You know, exterminate the brutes.
You know what? I am going to write the case for Ewoks. They weren't as bad as people. I mean, we should have had the Wookiees like
people. I hope you can find
like
some place to publish like that, Peter.
Yeah. On my Twitter
Peter,
feed.
Do you prefer the old racist stereotypes that George Lucas used to not even smuggle in but foreground in things like the Jewish traitor who owned Anakin's mother as he was a slaver, or Jar Jar Binks as a Rasta man?
I prefer nothing about George Lucas's prequels except for the only thing that was better about them. Than The Force Awakens and Rogue One, sort of the modern incarnation, is that they didn't just try to recycle old ideas over and over again, which is basically all we've seen so far. But no, everything about the prequels, including and especially the terrible racist stereotypes in bad early like motion capture CG. It was no good. I mean, Liam Neeson's kind of great, but that's just because Liam Neeson is great in everything.
Nick, do you have some stories you've been sitting on? The real truth in America?
Yeah, no, the real truth in America, a country that I no longer recognize, Matt. I miss a country that could be rely on Steve Garvey's forearms to muscle through a World Series win. I think the question about tax reform is still kind of up in the air, and whether or not Republicans are actually going to be able to reconcile a bill in time and what that is going to look like, that it's been treated as a fait accompli, and I think it might be more complicated than that, which would be kind of interesting because there's a lot to like about certain aspects of tax reform and there's a lot to dread, but it ain't over yet.
The deal that Susan Collins, who is potentially an important vote, although not the deciding vote at this point, the deal that she supposedly cut with Mitch McConnell, the House is now saying basically we don't have to honor that deal at all, and it could definitely throw a wrench into things. And then they're also discovering that because they wrote this thing literally in hours after making terrible deals with Jeff Flake and others on the day of the vote, or leading up to the evening of the vote, I guess I should say, like it's just riddled with errors. With not just like unintended consequences, but also those, but just drafting errors all over the place because they went about this thing in the fastest
dumbest way possible. It's going to be great when they bring in the same handwriting analyst who was looking at Roy Moore's yearbook inscriptions to figure out what's written in the margins. But there is that that special
way to make policy.
But there is that special porgs, duty-free thing coming in from China. So you'll get your plushies, Suderman,
no matter what. What is our porg policy I think, the question that we should have answered on this podcast.
Let the market decide. God damn
Give
it.
Give us, Matt, your only hope.
Catherine.
Sex and cake, always. That's what we should be talking about. Last week was the arguments in the Supreme Court. Masterpiece Cake Shop case. I think it's interesting because it is a thing about which reasonable libertarians disagree, although I think the vast majority of reasonable libertarians should be on my side, which is that you don't got to do what you don't want to do when you're running your own business. But there is
On what grounds? Because it's clear it's not a First Amendment case.
The
and then is it a religious case? Or is it just a general principle?
The thing that's interesting is that the court, at least in the hearings, focused much more on the speech element of it than court watchers, which is one of my favorite phrases, had anticipated. This question of whether if baking a cake is – if cake artistry is not an expressive act, what is, and how can you tell? You know, the sort of infinite hypotheticals in which we write on the cake that all lives matter, but decorate it with tiny Martin Luther Kings and things like that, is a glorious feature of our current political debate. I hope it sticks around for a while because it's actually important, unlike all of the garbage that we spend our time on every single day.
My cocktails are expressive speech, but I only serve them to people getting gay married.
See? Do it. Do you, Peter.
Well, if you have enough of them, everything's up for grabs, right, Peter?
I don't really think I want to take an up for grabs.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm channeling Matt Welch.
No grabbing. Stop it with the grabbing.
Let's end instead again with cake. Maybe it's too late in the recording to ask this, but do people actually think that
you should be able, on the basis of saying, because my God tells me this, or I interpret my God and my religion in such a way that I should be free from serving anybody? Or should it be, in an office independent of anti-discrimination laws that are passed at the state or federal or local level? Do people really believe that? And even if you agree with that principle that nobody should be forced to do something that they don't want to do, except in very extreme circumstances, should it be more of a general principle? Because, that to me, like in my sense, I am much more willing to say that, shop owners or business people should be given wide latitude to set whatever policies they want, whatever prices they want, business practices. But to peg that to the First Amendment, I don't think the Hobby Lobby case is particular. Well, they didn't. That was to freedom of religion or freedom of speech seems to me shaky and kind of special pleading.
I think the problem here is the little bit you said there about except in extreme circumstances. What we've learned is that governments and activists of all stripes always want to define their thing as an extreme circumstance. And that's why we end up throwing up very extreme bulwarks on the outer edges of liberty, because it will always wind up that cake and birth control pills and hotel rooms and everything in between is an extreme circumstance if you ask the government. That's why we shouldn't ask the government.
I am just going to point out that in the real and meat space, we call what Nick just did the French goodbye, which is that when you're right at the end of a transaction, end of a party, there's always that guest. Sometimes it's the host's fault, too, but the guest that lingers by the door and starts a new conversation.
See, I am a deep believer in the Irish goodbye, and I think that we should practice it now on our podcast.
Je regrette rien, or something like that.
All right. You've been listening to the Reason Podcast. I'm putting an Irish on this one. Please do subscribe to us on iTunes. Rate and review us while you're there. Reason Podcast has a bunch of different other kind of podcast interviews that happen all week long, and then we arrive on your doorstop every Monday afternoon, usually. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.